Well, we have the Ask Kirby events, and many of you have asked questions. The one I received was, what significance should we ascribe to Michio Kaku's claim that we clearly exist in a world made by rules, created by intelligence and not by chance? Can the mainstream scientific community ignore or counter to this? And I thought it was so simple, I was just going to let Parker answer that question. I showed this to Suzanne. She says, I don't even understand the question. Welcome to my world, okay? Well, those are the kinds of questions that I'm getting back there in the box on Ask Kirby. So I thought it would be a great opportunity to really spend some time talking about design. And if you say, well, I don't even know who Michio Kaku is, well, he is a professor of theoretical physics at City College of New York, and he's become quite a popularizer of science. And there's a real debate right now for people that are astronomers and theoretical physicists, because some of them say, no, even though there looks like there's a lot of design in the universe, it's just a result of chance. Then you have some that are saying, like him, that are maybe not necessarily Bible believers, but they sort of think, you know, maybe there's some kind of ordering principle here, because there's so much intelligence and design that maybe there were some rules that led to it. And then you get to another group of individuals, and these are actually born-again individuals that are astronomers who actually believe that that shows God. So I thought for just a minute I'd play a short video where you can kind of see that he doesn't really opt for kind of a biblical view of God, but at the same time, he's struggling with the fact that there's a lot of order and design in nature.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very big questions. Theoretical mm-hmm. physicists seem to come up against those throughout their entire careers.
That's why I became a theoretical physicist. I wanted to bump up against those big questions.
Constantly. And yeah. That's another question I was really interested in, is that I've heard that the majority of theoretical physicists are incredibly spiritual and have a great appreciation for the concept of consciousness and the soul and the universe and where it came from, because these are the questions that they're constantly asking. For yourself, what's your view on life, and, you know, where is it? What are we doing when we teleport life, if we ever get to that point?
Well, if I knew the answer to the life, I would have an inside track up there.
Right. That's what anybody, yeah.
But let me tell you how we physicists view things, mm-hmm. right? For example, Einstein was asked the big question, is there a God? Is there a meaning to everything, right?
Right.
And here's how Einstein answered the question. He said, there really are two kinds of gods. We have to be very scientific. We have to define what you mean by God. Mm-hmm. If God is the God of intervention, the personal God, the God of prayer, the God that parts the waters, then he had a hard time believing in that. Would God listen to all our prayers for a bicycle for Christmas and right. smite the Philistines for me, please?
Right.
He didn't think so. However, he believed in the God of order, harmony, beauty, simplicity, and elegance. The God of Spinoza. That's the God that he believed in, because he thought the universe was so gorgeous. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been chaotic. It could have been ugly, messy. But here we have the fact that all the equations of physics can be placed on a simple sheet of paper.
Right.
Einstein's equation is only 1 inch long. Mm-hmm. And the quantum theory is about a yard long, but you can squeeze it onto a sheet of paper.
Right, with a small enough font.
Right. And with string theory, you can even put those two equations together. And mm-hmm. string theory can be squeezed into an equation 1 inch long. And that equation, by the way, is my equation. That's string field theory. That's my contribution.
Right.
But we want to know, well, where did that equation come from? Mm-hmm. You know? This is what Einstein asked. Did God have a choice? Was there any choice in building a universe? When he woke up in the morning, he would say, I'm going to create a universe. I'm going to be God today. What kind of universe would I create? This is how he created much of his theories.
So again, I think that just gives you a little bit of an idea of that. And really, when you talk about the arguments for the existence of God, there are three that we oftentimes talk about. And one of those arguments is the cosmological argument, that we have this big effect, and so you have cause and effect, so there must have been a first cause. The second one, which we're going to look at today, is what is called the teleological argument, that design implies a designer. And the third is a moral argument, the fact that we have kind of this moral perspective perspective, that the fact that we have this idea of some kind of absolute moral law is another very good argument for God. And so for the next couple of minutes, I want to talk about the design argument. And this really comes originally from an individual that was a clergyman and philosopher by the name of William Paley. And his argument in his book, and there's an example of it there in Natural Theology, was that really when we look at the world, we see evidence of design. He said, for example, if you're just crossing a field, you know, and you see two different objects, a stone and a watch, we see something very different, obviously, because when we ask where did they come from, kind of the question that Michio Kaku was talking about just a minute ago, the stone is obviously a natural object, and just like other stones. But a watch, he said, was really in a different category because it shows planning, it shows craftsmanship, it shows beauty and usefulness. And so the argument he made is a watch demands a watchmaker. Design implies a designer. Now, this causes a real problem for our atheist friends, because even the evolutionist out there will acknowledge that this world does look like it's designed. That's what Romans 1 says. So how do they get around that? Well, Richard Dawkins actually taken this idea of a watchmaker and wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. Atheist Richard Dawkins argues basically that evolution produces something that looks like it's designed, but it's not. In other words, don't trust your lying eyes. It looks like it was designed. Don't believe that because it has design, there's a designer. Really, it's just a result of mass, energy, chance, and time. And so he has come up with this idea of the blind watchmaker. So for the next couple of minutes, because we got started late, I'll probably have to cut short one of the videos. But what I'm going to do is take you through a couple of very, I think, powerful arguments that have actually led to the conversion of some individuals. I mentioned some of these astronomers now that are believers, Guillermo Gonzalez, you could mention, and others. One of those is a man by the name of Alan Sandage. He was an evolutionary scientist who argued for the idea of an oscillating universe. But as he began to look at the facts, he began to realize, no, if anything, the universe really demonstrates the existence of God, and he became a Christian. And so some of these individuals are becoming theists, and that's sort of like Michio Kaku, who doesn't really believe in the God of the Bible. It's pretty obvious. He talks about Spinoza's God. But then there are others that have actually looked at this evidence and said, you know, this really does show intelligent design. So if you're taking some notes, and you have in your handout here some of the things that you can look at, I'm going to show you a couple of points and then show you a couple of videos to make the case. And for some of you that say, boy, maybe this came real quickly, or I'd like to show this to my children or my grandchildren, this is available at the bottom of the handout. You notice it says PrestonWoodExamine.org, which means you can go back and hear this presentation and see these slides. So again, that will be a way that you could revisit this. But when we talk about design in nature, if you want to put some scripture verses down, one that certainly I think applies is the book of Isaiah. And in chapter 40 of Isaiah here, God, in a sense, says, lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. Who is it? The One, Yahweh, who leads forth their hosts by number. He calls them all by name. That means that God has named all of the stars. Do you know how many stars there are in the Milky Way galaxy? The two astronomers can't answer. 100 billion stars estimated in just the Milky Way galaxy that we're in alone. Now, some are saying, well, maybe there's not 100 billion, but what's a billion stars among friends? You know, it's pretty close anywhere. That's right order of magnitude. And that's just in the galaxy that we're in. And on the Star Watch party, we're going to show you some other galaxies further away, like the Dumbbell Galaxy. Aren't we looking at that and a few of those others? But again, it goes on, because he calls them all by their name because of the greatness of his might and the strength that his power, not one of them is missing. You want to make an argument for the sovereignty of God? There's a key verse for it, so that is certainly the case. Well, we could look at all the things in the universe, but I thought we'd just stay in our solar system for a minute, because when we look at even our Earth and our solar system, we see what seems to be a design. Because look at just the size of the Earth. The Earth, as we look at it, is just about the right size. if it was too much smaller, it wouldn't have enough gravitational pull to keep the atmosphere here. And we need to breathe in the atmosphere. So a smaller planet is too small. A larger planet's too big, and then complex life couldn't exist on it either. So it's kind of like what? A Goldilocks planet, isn't it? Remember Goldilocks and the Three Bears? So certainly the size of the Earth is just right. Its distance from the sun is very, very important, because we recognize that if the Earth was really just only about 5% closer to the sun, you'd have almost a runaway greenhouse effect. If it got too close to the sun, as we're going to see in a video in a minute, it would no longer rotate because the gravitational pull of the sun would keep it from rotating. If it was about 20% further away, it'd be too cold, it would freeze up, and again, you would not have complex life. We're in kind of a solar habitable zone right here in the solar system. Then we have its axial tilt, and that gives us the variation of the seasons and all the things that are associated with that. You have the Earth's temperature, which again is moderated by the atmosphere we have, the ozone layer, and much more. And then the very important thing of the moon. You know, when we see other moons in not only our solar system, but in other galaxies, we have a very large moon. Eugene even gave me a book a while back where some people argued that the moon had to have been created by extraterrestrials or aliens, because it's just right size in the right place for all the things that we enjoy. Well, I think it was created, but not by an extraterrestrial, by the way. But nevertheless, you can begin to see all of these issues coming together that are just right. So I thought I'd play just a short little video from The Privileged Planet, which is done by Illustria Media, just to illustrate how, again, why astronomers looking at all this are saying there's a lot more design, and maybe design implies a designer.
If a recipe for a planet capable of supporting complex life really did exist, then what ingredients, beyond liquid water, might be required? The list of necessary factors continues to grow.
We live on this paper-thin crust. If the Earth's crust were significantly thicker, then plate tectonic recycling could not take place.
The Earth's crust varies in thickness from about 4 to 30 miles. It consists of more than a dozen tectonic plates that are in constant motion. This dynamic geology regulates the planet's interior temperature, recycles carbon, mixes chemical elements essential to living organisms, and shapes the continents. Deep within the Earth's interior, the movement of liquid iron generates a protective magnetic field essential to complex life. If our planet was smaller, its magnetic field would be weaker, allowing the solar wind to strip away our atmosphere, slowly transforming the Earth into a dead, barren world much like Mars.
We need an oxygen atmosphere, and the oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere that the Earth has is necessary for complex life.
As seen from space, the Earth's atmosphere glows as a thin blue ribbon of light. Measuring less than 1% of the planet's diameter, it is composed of a mixture of nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. As a result, our atmosphere ensures a temperate climate, protection from the sun's radiation, and the correct combination of gases necessary for liquid water and complex life.
For a size of planet like Earth, our moon is big. The current thinking is that if our moon didn't exist, neither would we.
One-fourth the size of the Earth, the moon's powerful gravitational pull stabilizes the angle of its axis at a nearly constant 23.5 degrees. This ensures relatively temperate seasonal changes, and the only climate in the solar system mild enough to sustain complex living organisms.
If we find life out there, especially complex or even intelligent life, it will be around a star similar to our own.
we orbit what is known as a spectral type G2 dwarf main sequence star. It is well suited for our needs. If the Sun were less massive, like 90% of the stars in the galaxy, the habitable zone would be smaller. To remain within its boundaries, the Earth would have to be positioned closer to its star. Here, increased gravity would lock our planet's rotation into synchronization with its orbit. While one side of the Earth continually faced the Sun and increased radiation from solar flares, the dark side of the planet would lay shrouded in perpetual cold and ice. It is unlikely complex life could tolerate these drastic extremes in temperature.
A lot of things went right on Earth to have yielded complex life, absolutely.
The number of factors that have been postulated has grown. Currently, the typical number you would see is, in a typical list, would have something like 20.
We find that we need to be at the right location in the galaxy, that we're inside the circumstellar habitable zone of a star, that we're in a planetary system with giant planets that can shield the inner planets from too many comet impacts, that we're orbiting the right kind of star that's not too cool or not too hot, that we're on a planet that has a moon that can stabilize the tilt of its axis, that we're on a planet that's a terrestrial planet, a planet that has a crust that's just thick enough that it can maintain plate tectonic activity, that has enough heat in its interior that it's still circulating its liquid iron core so it can generate a magnetic field, that it has an atmosphere that has enough oxygen to allow for complex organisms to survive, that it has enough water and enough continents to allow for the diversity of life or an active biosphere that you need to support complex creatures such as ourselves. All these factors have to be met at one place and time in the galaxy if you're going to have a planet as habitable as the Earth, which you need for complex and even technological life.
In an attempt to estimate the probability of attaining this combination of factors simultaneously, some researchers have developed equations assigning a conservative 1 in 10 value to each factor deemed necessary for advanced life.
If every element has to be there at the same time, you have to multiply the probabilities. And that's what makes the probability at the end so small. You've got 10% of this and 10% of that, and these things rapidly multiply to exceedingly small numbers. The numbers on the order of 10 to minus 15, which is 1,000th of 1 trillion. And it's a number like that that you have to compare to the 100 billion stars that are in the galaxy. 100 billion is a very large number, but 1,000th of a trillion is much, much smaller. On their face value, these probabilities are speaking. What they're telling us is this can't happen, or this is very unlikely to happen in the galaxy. And that's where the evidence is pushing us.
There are many probabilistic resources in the galaxy, but on the other side of the coin are all these factors that you need. You have to get just right in order to have just one habitable planet like the Earth. And that leads me to conclude that, yes, we're rare in the galaxy.
While a growing body of scientific evidence may support this hypothesis, does the possibility that our planet is rare within the galaxy imply anything about its significance?
Nils, that gives you a little bit of a sense of just how, why there are so many scientists today that are beginning to rethink some of the ideas that they had. Robert Jastrow is an individual that identifies himself as an agnostic and works at the Goddard Space Institute, but nevertheless, in his most recent book, ended the chapter by saying, "For the scientist who has lived by the faith and the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." A key verse, if you want to put it down there, would be Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. And if nothing else, we can certainly see that in astronomy. In the interest of time, let me also mention that we can look at design in astronomy. We can also look at design in biology. And one of the things that, if we'd had more time, I would have shown is a video from Unlocking the Mystery of Life. But I'll take that one out just in the interest of time, but you can find out more about it. And I was going to take you into what is happening inside the cell. But I think I'll skip that one real quickly and maybe just do something that maybe is a little less scientific, but kind of fun. And that is, we have all sorts of creatures that also defy evolution. You know, if evolution is true, then theoretically you've had these small little changes, supposedly through mutations, and these accumulate over time, and so you get some kind of fitness, you get the kind of survival of the fittest, and so you should be able to see sort of graduated chains. But the problem is there are all sorts of creatures out there that completely defy evolution. I figure I'd pick out one, and that was the pileated woodpecker. We've got some woodpeckers out near our house, so I watch them pretty interestingly. And if you think about this, first of all, they're pretty unusual creatures. You ever seen one of them just go tut-tut-tut-tut-tut? You can't move your hand as fast as they can move their head. I wouldn't recommend you pounding your head into something either, like it is doing all the simple of the time. But why is it doing that? Well, it's doing that to collect insects. Well, in order to do that, it has a tongue that is actually about four times longer than its head. Nicholas, stick your tongue out. You can't probably stick it out more than even a quarter of an inch there past your head. But the woodpecker does so, and the reason it's able to do so is this. And that is, if you look at how the tongue is retracting, it goes all the way not only to the top of its head, but then also is connected to the top of its nose. And so when it constricts it, they stick the tongue way, way out. Now think about how you would do that from an evolutionary point of view. You know, the tongue has got to move from the back of your throat somewhere to your head. Does that make any sense evolutionary? Then you've got to somehow evolutionary have it evolve to eventually get to the point where it's at the top of your head, and you can begin to see that there are all sorts of animals out here that cause even hardcore evolutionists a little bit of difficulty in trying to explain how they come about. But again, since you seem to enjoy the videos, let's talk about something else that's a real challenge. And, here we go. Let's back it up here for a second. There we go. And that is to talk about this issue of metamorphosis. This is another real great challenge for evolutionists because, as we well know, that a moth will go into come from a cocoon, or a butterfly comes from a chrysalis. And I want you for just a minute to look at what we might call butterfly magic and recognize how remarkable this is and how it cannot possibly be explained from an evolutionary point of view.
A butterfly chrysalis connects two fundamentally different ways of living. It is both a bridge and a workshop where one type of organism is transformed into another. The magnitude of this transformation has been compared to a Model T Ford that suddenly encases itself within a garage. Inside, most of the car breaks down into fragments of metal, rubber, and glass. These pieces then reorganize themselves into components more complex than any that previously existed in the Model T. After several days, the garage door bursts open and a radically different mode of transportation lifts off into the sky.
Now, an analogy like that is pure whimsy. But even if it were somehow possible, I don't think turning a car into a helicopter would be nearly as impressive as the actual transformation that takes place inside a chrysalis.
From the moment the chrysalis is formed, caterpillar tissues are destroyed and then recycled to help build wings, compound eyes, reproductive organs, and navigational systems of stunning beauty and efficiency. Yet despite the importance of cell death in the chrysalis, the origin of the process defies the basic logic of natural selection.
One of the fundamental requirements of natural selection is reproduction. You've got to be able to make copies of yourself, in particular of your genes. You've got to be able to pass them on. But a chrysalis, unless it represents a bridge to something yet to come, is really a casket. If you're a caterpillar, you're entering your own grave. Turning most of your body into a molecular soup would be suicide.
A caterpillar, unless it makes it through to the adult, is no good because it can't reproduce. You're not going to have offspring, and so you're a dead-end street evolutionarily. So it wouldn't be any benefit at all to kill yourself unless you've got a hidden plan up your sleeve. You know, like, okay, I know I can go ahead and commit suicide because there's a new me waiting to happen.
The caterpillar is not going to enter the chrysalis without simultaneously knowing, I've got a plan for getting out of this. I'm heading towards the adult butterfly. I'm going to reconstitute these tissues in the adult form, emerge, and go on my way. But that's not how natural selection operates. It can't look into the future and somehow anticipate what an evolving organism is going to need in a week or a month or 1,000 years from now. So if the first caterpillars were evolving into existence, without foresight, it's highly unlikely natural selection would retain a destructive process like cell death.
So again, that just gives you a little bit of an idea. And in that particular message, there are a couple of things. First of all, just to think about this, if you were to watch the whole video, it takes you from the history of the butterfly with an egg, just the pinpoint, all the way through the caterpillar. But more importantly, something else which is a real challenge for evolution is the fact that you have things like these monarch butterflies that will travel all the way from Canada to Mexico, and they don't have a GPS. Just think about that for just a minute. You know that those of you that have ever done any flying, that you're just off by a fraction of a percent, you can end up in the wrong place entirely. And we now know that these butterflies actually eat some things that have a little bit of metal, and they then orient themselves according to the North Pole. And that's how they, with perfect accuracy, travel those long distances. And so it's just a little bit in that video that just reminds you again that there are all sorts of things that simply cannot be explained from an evolutionary point of view. So whether you're looking at astronomy and saying, do we have evidence of design in astronomy? Yes, we do. We also have evidence for design in biology. And with that, I thought I might also just play a little short piece here about flight, because this not only helps you understand the issue of flight, but again, not only do butterflies, but these birds navigate incredible distances. And again, this is a real challenge for the theory of evolution.
It never ceases to amaze me that birds live in the air. Their environment is this invisible fluid that surrounds us, the atmosphere. If you don't take that for granted, the question that should naturally occur to you is, how do they fly? When I was growing up, my father worked as an aeronautical engineer. And one of the principles that he taught me that I've really never forgotten is, if something works, it's not happening by accident. Successfully flying, I mean really flying, controlled flight, it's going to have to be coordinated, carefully engineered. I imagine human beings sitting and watching birds for millennia, yearning to be able to do what the birds do. And finally, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, we figure out how to do it for ourselves with the aid of a machine.
As long as human beings have walked the earth, their eyes and hearts have turned to the skies. Our fascination with flight and the desire to experience it have inspired a myriad of inventions that can lift us, at least momentarily, into the avian world. But for all of the creative brilliance their construction requires, a mechanically powered aircraft of any design pales when compared to a gull on the wing. For a bird is the ultimate flying machine, and to see one glide in the wind is to observe what the poet William Blake once called a portion of genius. More than 9,000 species of birds have been identified in the world, and nearly all of them can fly. They thrive in every environment, each equipped to endure specific challenges of climate and geography, and each the result of a biological process executed to perfection within an amazing vessel. Ranging in weight from less than an ounce to more than 3 pounds, a fertilized egg is a package of life. A factory where the mechanisms that will carry out every facet of a bird's existence are meticulously crafted in a matter of weeks. Depending upon its species, a female can lay as many as 20 eggs in a season. Then, she will devote herself to their care throughout an incubation period that usually lasts between 2 and 7 weeks. Since Aristotle, scientists have studied the eggs of a chicken to unlock the mysteries of a bird's development from a single cell.
Remember that all birds develop in the same way. So if I'm looking at a superb flying bird, let's say a swift or a swallow or something like that, it's going to develop in about the same way as a chicken embryo develops. And every mechanism that is necessary for flight, every adaptation for flight that you find in doves, that you find in eagles, vultures, they're all there in a chicken.
The developmental process begins soon after fertilization and accelerates once the egg is laid, as thousands of cells rapidly multiply and organize inside the protective shell.
In the early hours, you see the foundation for this organism that's coming later on being laid down. You see the front and the back and the top and the bottom and all of those things being worked out in this cascade of events.
Where's the head going to be? Where's the tail going to be? What's right? What's left? What's front versus back? Already, these major axes are being established. And as these cells are moving and heading towards the places in the embryo where they're going to develop, they're also changing what they're going to do eventually. They're committing themselves, in most cases, irreversibly to particular functional roles.
On day 2, the bird's spinal cord, ears, and eyes take shape. Its vascular and circulatory systems are established, and its heart beats for the first time. At hour 46, the head of the embryo starts to arch into the fetal position. Throughout the second day,
a network of blood vessels branches from the embryo into the yolk. They will transport vital nutrients back to the growing organism.
You gotta pay attention to the details. You have genes being switched on and off, interaction, cell communication. It's an elaborate dance. It's like a ballet taking place on a stage with thousands of cast members. All of them doing everything they're supposed to on cue, in the right order, in the right sequence, in the right time. The process itself is so amazing. It transcends anything we know.
With the groundwork of major systems and organs now in place, the next 19 days are devoted to the completion of their development.
I think I'll go on just because I wanted to leave a little bit of time for some other things, but if nothing else, it gives you an idea of what happens inside the cell. But I wanted to end by also talking about the design in the human body. And if you're taking some notes, you might put that down as well, because in Psalm 139, what do we read? You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. My works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And I thought, just real quickly, in the last few minutes we have here, I might just talk about the fact that when we look at all living cells, but even cells in our own body, it's amazing because each cell, as I put up there, is incredibly complex. It's surrounded by a membrane that is thinner than a spider's web. Each day you have to produce energy, and that is what's called ADP and ATP. It's adenosine triphosphate. You don't need to know all of that. But we use that, and we are producing that constantly. And each day, we actually produce our own body weight in that chemical. So it just shows you all the things that are happening inside your cells right now, just as you're sitting there, without you giving any conscious effort at all. When we look at our eyes, for example, Charles Darwin said, you know, the eye made him shudder because he realized that the eye was very difficult to explain from evolution. Because for the eye to work, you need all the pieces. You need the retina, the cornea, the optic nerve, and everything. Well, if all of that's supposed to evolve over time, until you have all the pieces together, an eye really doesn't work, does it? And so, again, that was a real challenge for him. But again, just think about how complex the eye is. You know, we are now talking about using iris scans because there are 266 different identifiable characteristics compared to a fingerprint of only 35. But more than that, just think about what you see. When light hits the retina, you have 120 million rods and 7 million cones. Now, unless you're an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, you might say, I don't know what that is. Well, the rods are those which help you with dim vision and night vision and peripheral vision. The cones help you with color vision as well as fine detail. And you have 1 million nerve fibers in your eye so that you can see up here on the screen right now what you're seeing. Then when you look at how sensitive it is, we are sensitive to sometimes just even one or two photons, to give you that idea. And a strong flashlight issues that number of photons. So it gives you an idea, for example, how significant our eyes are. At the same time, our eyes can distinguish millions of different shades of colors. By the way, this is one place where the women are a lot better at distinguishing colors than the men. They do have a much greater ability in that regard. You can see, interestingly enough, a candle 30 miles away and a really dark night, which shows you the sensitivity of your eyes. We talk about your ears. You're listening to me right now, and your ear is made up of, interestingly enough, a number of things. A very sensitive eardrum that's about as thick as a sheet of paper. You can hear just very, very insignificant, very small amounts of sound through those. The ear basically has almost a million moving parts, and it has some of the tiniest bones in the body. And yet here you can hear all sorts of things that I'm saying right now and have what's called audio discrimination. Well, one of the ones that I found most intriguing is that there is a process by which your brain can determine by the way in which sound waves hit your ears where something comes from. We could all close our eyes right now and have somebody clap their hands, and all of you could probably point to exactly where that came from. And that's because your ears, tied to your brain, can determine whether the sound hit one ear just a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second before it hit the other one. And that's where you can determine where that particular sound comes from. We have in our brains and in our eyes and in our ears things which we still, from a mechanical point of view, have not been able to replicate even here in the 21st century. A couple more real quickly since we've been talking about this. Okay, jumped one. There we go. Down nose, okay? So in eye, ears, nose. Nose can distinguish 10,000 different smells. Of course, we have an ability with our taste buds, 9,000 different taste buds. We can, with our fingers, detect very small bumps on glass and things of that nature, just illustrating, again, just the incredible bodies that we're walking around with. Are we fearfully and wonderfully made? You know, if you go to a medical school, you learn a lot more about this. But one last one I thought, and that is our brains. Our brains are more advanced than most of the computers we have in the world because we have 100 billion neurons up there in your brain, each of which can be in contact with 10,000 other neurons, which then gives us a storage capacity in our brains, which is equal to 25 million books in terms of bits and bytes. To put that in perspective, the Library of Congress only has 17 million books. So in other words, you've got all sorts of information up there. Now, when you get a little bit older, it's trying to find that in that brain there. But, you know, nevertheless, it's all stored up there. And the brain is, and these neurons firing at 1,000 trillionth of a second. And so this is, again, the most complex entity in the universe is right between your two ears. By the way, that means take very good care of it. That means wearing a bike helmet, right? That means not drinking, all sorts of other things, you know. Take care of that brain because it's what God has given you. And it just, again, will give you a sense of the fact that when we look at the stars in astronomy, as we'll do on our next Star Watch, we can see design in nature in the telescope. We look at the small dimensions, which we didn't have a chance to go into. In the microscope, we see design as well. When we look at our own bodies, I think we see design. And so let me just recommend that if over the summer you'd like to study some of this, maybe you have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, maybe you just like to study it, here's a couple of these videos, and I've only played short clips of these. These are the clips I show oftentimes when I teach creation evolution in Oregon every fall. I'm usually gone for one Sunday to do that. I actually should give you the same credit the students in Oregon get, but nevertheless, there is The Privileged Planet, and there is a book and a DVD that goes with it, Unlocking the Mystery of Life. We didn't have a chance to look at that, but that takes you into the cell and look at the intricacies of the cell. And then I've showed you one called Metamorphosis and also one called Flight. Now, you could certainly order them on Amazon, but they also, I think, make it available for you to actually just go to YouTube and download it, so you could download it to your computer. So if you... Yeah, and we have some in the library over. You could rent them from the Prestonwood Library, or if you need, I've got all of them, and I'll be glad to lend them to you as well. But there would be a great opportunity for you to see design in nature. So I thank everyone for the question from Michio Keku, but if nothing else, that reminds us of the importance of looking at design in nature. And Parker, come back up here. You have some follow-up slides, so let's turn it back over to him.